It is customary for us to pause a few moments for silent prayer, and this allows you to use the time for rebound if necessary and shift gears into strict academic discipline. Shall we pray? Father, we appreciate the opportunity to continue our pursuit of truth. It is our prayer that what we do here this evening will contribute to that objective. And we lift our prayer in Christ's name. Amen. We are studying the parable in Matthew chapter 20. It is a parable that takes up management and labor. And we have worked our way down to in the neighborhood of verse 10. And I want to go back and remind you that the first several verses were outlining how a man who owned a vineyard staffed his workforce with those that he found in the agora. And he would go there and find people who wanted work and hire them and send them into his vineyard. The first group bargained with him for a price of one denarius a day, which was a fair day's wage. And then when he decided that he needed more people in the vineyard working, he went back to the agora and began to hire others and promised them simply a fair wage. There was no contract involved other than his statement that he would be fair with them. And once the day was over, then he began to call everyone in and notified his payroll clerk to pay them accordingly. And in verse 8, we find that at 6 o'clock, the viticulturalist said to his payroll clerk, "Call the workers and pay them their wages." And then verse 9, the employees who were hired around 5 o'clock came to the payroll clerk and each received a fair day's wage. The fair day's wage is a denarius. That is the amount of money that the original group agreed to under contract. And then verse 10, so when those came who were hired first to the payroll clerk, they presumptively assumed that they would receive more than the others who were hired at later hours in the day. The first group began work at 6 and they were done at 6. But each one of them in the first group, each one of them received a fair day's wage, which is what they were under contract to receive. They had bargained for this and they had received that for which they had bargained, a denarius, a fair day's wage. This is exactly the same amount of money that others received, regardless of the hour of the day that they were hired. Now, in effect, the first group was a union because they bargained for their amount of pay. Today, they would be the United Farm Workers. That is a legitimate comparison because one of the primary tasks that the United Farm Workers take on, in California at least, is harvesting grapes out of the vineyards in Napa Valley. So the United Farm Workers did have a firm contract with the vineyard owner, and they negotiated with him. Now, he is the capitalist, and they are the laborers. Therefore, they have assumed wrongly on this occasion. They bargained with the owner for a fair day's wage. Management was fair and just in giving them what the contract called for. Nothing more and nothing less. When you enter into a contract, that's it. You will be paid what you bargained for. And that's exactly what the vineyard owner did. Now tonight we move into verse 11. The King James Version reads this way. When they had received it, their pay, they murmured against the good man of the house. The good man of the house here is the payroll clerk. And he, though, is functioning in the stead of the landowner, the vineyard owner, who has instructed him to pay out the wages. The word murmured here is gudzo. Let me give that to you. This is sometimes confusing. I've been questioned about this in the past. That's gonguzo. This is a double G here, but in Greek, when a G precedes another G or a chi or a kappa, then it's transliterated as NG. gungudzo, and this means to complain. It means to show dissatisfaction by whining. I don't know if you've ever whined before, if you were ever a child, and we all started out as a child. We've done some whining. But if you've grown to adulthood and say you've whined around the office or whined in some other function, whined around the golf course, I whine a lot during baseball season. I whine at the TV. I whined this afternoon on a horrible call at first base. And so did Tony La Russa, by the way. He whined. And this is gungudzo, or gungudzo, accurately pronounced. It means to grumble, a low, indistinct, and continuous murmuring. It means to criticize, to find fault with one's methods, policies, or intentions. So you're casting aspersions upon someone, and it's an unjust accusation when you start this complaining and whining. It means to gripe, to complain with sustained grumbling, to malign, to utter false reports, or to suggest subtle misrepresentations, to spew, which means to vomit. This is matter that exudes in a flood or a gush. Now, these all describe the kinds of mental attitudes that are behind this murmuring, this complaining, this whining. And therefore, they're regurgitating their own mental attitude sins, their presumptive ideas about their worth and how they've been wronged and how the landowner is unjust, how they therefore have been taken advantage of, forgetting all the time that they bargained for the amount of money that they received. So there are several points that we can draw from this. These workers are instantly reacting to their paycheck, a paycheck that they bargained for, and they reacted to that. And the only reason they reacted to it is others came in during the day and at the end of the day received the same amount of money that they did. Had they worked the entire day as was originally planned, with no one else coming into the vineyard, they would have been happy as punch when the day was over. They would have received what they bargained for, they would have been happy with it, and they would have gone home. But certain things intervene that cause them to change their mental attitude. And so secondly, the reaction is brought about by a false conclusion, which they reached in their own minds prior to being paid. Their mental attitude changed from 6 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock in the afternoon. They presumptively assumed that when the paycheck came in that they would be paid more because others who were paid first, remember that the landowner said pay them in reverse order, which he did, which means those that came in at 5 o'clock and worked 1 hour received a denarius, and so on back up to the 9 o'clock shift. They all received the same amount of money. So suddenly, as this process takes place before them, they start steaming, they start getting mad and angry, and they start deciding how they're going to present their case. They're going to complain, and that amounts to gungudzo. Thirdly, by assuming they would be paid over and above the agreed upon amount, they react with what they view is a less amount, but it is exactly what they bargained for. Four, they are guilty of an arrogant presupposition that because some co-workers worked less time, then they will be paid more regardless of what they originally agreed to. And this means that they want to break the contract and that the landowner, the vineyard owner, should, if he's fair and just with them, come to them and say, I am going to tear up the original contract because you worked longer than these others. But it was a mutually agreed to contract, and therefore he has been honest and fair and just with them. So five, this leads to a false hope, and false hope spurned leads to consternation, and consternation leads to confusion. They were spurned, they feel, because they've been paid what they feel is an unjust amount, although they agreed to it in the beginning. They do not function on principle, but on presupposed standards, which are expedient for them alone. Expediency, therefore, becomes the sin here. When you are expedient, it means you want to take advantage of a circumstance that you believe benefits you, but oftentimes is a detriment to others. Expediency is where you take advantage of a situation unfairly. they are casting aspersions upon the landowner that he is being unfair when it is they that are being so. So that's what we have here, expediency. They are expedient. They seek what is advantageous to self without regard for ethics or concern with principle. The principle is your word should be your bond. You entered into an agreement and a contract, and you should be pleased with the result of it. Cut a new deal for tomorrow if that same job is available. But today, they get a denarius. Point eight, they are governed by self-interest. And this is a part of expediency, because when you are expedient, the major issue in your mind is your self-interest. I'm doing this for my own benefit, and I don't care who it hurts, and I don't care about other people that are involved. This is all about me. That self-interest, and that comes from expediency. Nine, such mental attitudes indicate a soul void of principle, honor, or integrity. In other words, the rules change as you need them to. Now, often we're in situations to where we enter into an arrangement. We understand the rules and regs, but as time moves on and these rules and regs seem to be a disadvantage to us in our mind's eye, we want to change them. And that's what you have in many offices today. They enter into a job. There are policies there. The policies are expected to be adhered to by everyone. And they find that a few of them are disadvantageous to them, and they want to either ignore them, they want to change them, and if they can't do either, they complain and whine. But when you're on a job, there's company policy, and they may be unjust and unfair, and these policies may not be the best that could have been put into play. But they are in play that everyone else must adhere to, and you must do the same until something is changed. And the best way to get it changed is to obey them. If everyone obeyed a bad policy, management would eventually see that it needed to be changed. So rather than complain, go with the policy. So such mental attitudes indicate a soul void of principle, honor, or integrity. 10, they think more highly of themselves than they ought to think. And when that occurs, a person is moved into arrogance and self-centeredness. It's all about them, and it's not about the objective before them, which is to get the grapes out of the vineyard. Number 11, when self-centered arrogance is challenged, it always reacts. So that's a reactor factor. You can check yourself out. There are two responses to an exigency. You can react to it or you can respond to it. Now, exigencies, I like to use that word because it can be something minor or it can be something catastrophic. It's just something not on your day timer. And so when you're confronted with an exigency that's not on your day timer and causes you some kind of dismay, or is something that you did not expect and you consider it to be a detriment to you, then you begin to wonder if there's anything you can do about it. Is there anything unfair about this? And therefore you become self-centered and you react to it. The issue for the believer is to respond to it with doctrine. And the doctrine that would apply here is a man ought to be good for his word. They shook hands on it, and that's that. It doesn't matter what happened with the other people. Integrity says, I gave my word, and that's the end of it. Point 12. These workers know and remember the contract to which they agreed. It's not that they forgot it. It was only 12 hours ago. They bargained for it. They won it. It went into play. It was fulfilled. They therefore did not forget. So they know that they agreed to this denarius. 13. But it now seems, quote, only fair that they now should get more than what they agreed to work for. It seems unfair to them that they're being paid a denarius. What they believe would be fair is if they were paid more than all the rest. And the reason, their rationale is they worked longer. Not only did they work longer, they worked in more adverse conditions, which comes out in the passage a little later. Number 14, it therefore becomes expedient that they find fault with a system with which they profess to be unfair. So this is projection. Everything was fine at 6 o'clock. It's not okay at 6 p.m. Therefore, they project their dismay on the landowner and accuse him of being unfair. 15, they have no recourse but to grumble among themselves that this whole thing is grossly unfair and that the capitalist is guilty of playing favorites at best or union busting at worst. So they got him either way. He's unfair or he's involved in union busting. And they're going to complain about it. And I guess they could take it to the Labor Relations Board this day and time and give their grievance and most likely win. We'll get into the passage a little later. Remember, there's an establishment application which we're looking at first, and then we're going to see the spiritual application. When we do that, you will see that grace is involved in this and that you are the recipient of the grace that is indicated in this parable. We'll note that in due time. 16, they actually have no real complaint, but they invent wrongdoing by their employer. They invent it out of thin air, and they hope that this will embarrass him into coming around to their way of thinking. So 18, these macho men talk tough among themselves, but do not have the courage to confront the capitalist on an individual basis. See, what you need to do when you go to work is decide where you want to work, go to management, and see if they're willing to hire you based on what your knowledge happens to be. If you know how to do certain things, maybe you can get a job doing that. And you can agree with them on an amount of money that you will be paid if you accomplish the objective. And that's between you and them. And you succeed or fail based on your abilities to perform, rather than going as a group and saying this group wants to bargain. Well, look, how do you know that out of 100 people, let's say, and I know that's a small number, but it's a round figure, out of 100 people will all work at the same level of efficiency? Do all have the same level of knowledge? Do all have the same motivation? Do all have the same level of integrity? Why should all get paid the same thing when there are variations in these types of qualifications among the 100? Shouldn't they be paid what they're worth, their advantage to the company, their advantage to the stockholders, and so on? Each person should be evaluated on his own abilities rather than coming as a group. And therefore, this bunch here has decided that they're the best grape pickers in town and deserve a denarius a day. And when they get it, they're not happy because they bargain as a group. I wonder if each and every one of them picked the same number of grapes. So 19, thus they turn to their surrogate mama, the union rep, and send him to go and negotiate their case. Here comes Cesar Chavez. He's our guy. All these mental machinations result in an evil act of seeking to create power where there is no power. They have no power. They have nothing to bargain with. They agreed to it. But if, as a group, they can send a representative and issue a grievance. And the grievance, therefore, has to be taken today before some board, and they decide, well, who's been fair and who hasn't. You can sign a contract today. These things are negotiated over the course of weeks sometime. And once the contract is done, then you have all of these wonderful advantages that have been agreed to by management. And if you happen to be General Motors, you've agreed to more than you can stay in business with. The issue is, can we make a profit and keep all of you guys working? And if we can keep all of you working, at the same time, those of you who retired, can we keep giving you money from a pension fund? And can we keep having everyone in your family, as long as they live, have a wonderful insurance policy, health insurance, and all these other advantages? These are wonderful things. And as long as General Motors was able to crank out good cars and people would buy them and they made a profit, all was working well. But then it turned out that all of that was costing more than they could make in profit, so they had to jack the price of each car by about $1,500 to $2,000, while Toyota and Honda was able to make them cheaper because they didn't have these really wonderful benefits for their employees. So where's General Motors and Chrysler today? Well, they're taking money from the surrogate mama and trying to stay in business. And that's what leads to a socialist environment. It's a fascism kind of an approach. Fascism is where the government tries to run the business. And so now we have the government running car companies. None of these guys in the government even drive cars. I've seen it on television. They get brought to work in limousines. There are other people who do the driving. They don't know how to crank a car, yet they own the company. All these mental machinations result in an evil act of seeking to create power where there is no power. Finally, 21, only souls filled with evil can devise such. And when an evil soul reacts as these have, they regurgitate their contents for all to see. What's the real mental attitude? It is gimme, 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 more, more, more. I want to be given an advantage I don't deserve. And when denied, they regurgitate the contents of their soul for everyone to see. Therefore, they have a self-centered attitude. They have self-centered comments that result, and therefore they reveal their evil intentions. So verse 11 reads this way. Thus, when they had received their fair day's wage, they spewed their souls toward the capitalist. So we have some notes now on Gongudzo. The spewing, the regurgitation, the murmuring, the whining. Point one. The word always carries a subjective application. It carries the view that nothing is being done to rectify a just claim. Now that's the intention of the grumbling. We've been treated unjustly, and now what we're doing is verbalizing the reasons this unjust act should be rectified. And this is all behind this Greek word gongudzo. Secondly, gongudzo is the external conduct which reveals the mental attitude and temperament of the individual. You can reveal who you are by what you say, by your body language. You can tell when a person is upset, when they're being arrogant, when a person is being in opposition, when he's disgusted, when he's aggravated. It's easy to tell what people are thinking without them having to say a word. But these people regurgitate these attitudes with their mumbling and their grumbling and their whining. So, by the way, people know what you're thinking without you saying anything by your countenance, your mental attitude. In fact, there are Proverbs and there are Psalms about one's countenance. And the countenance of the individual face is commented upon quite often in the Proverbs and the Psalms. So you don't really have to say anything for people to know what you're thinking. Unless you know how to play poker, of course. By the way, I don't know how to play poker. I don't know. Poker, I mean. I tried that. I made a lot of money when I was a teenager. More than any, I was the richest guy in town. My dad paid me $1 an hour for the first 40 hours. And for all hours after that, he paid me nothing. I worked 60 hours a week for $40 a week, but that was a lot of money in 1960. And I got to playing 7-card stud. And after, I don't know, several months of that, I realized that they were winning my money that I had to earn sweating on the front of that tire store, spinning that lug wrench, and I gave it up. I kept my money. Started buying Sweet Henry a lot of stuff. The mental attitude nor its manifestations are ever considered to be an attribute. Such a trait reveals one to be a person without virtue. I told my dad one day that spinning a lug wrench was not my ambition on a hot August day. And I'd been fighting the front of that tire store all day long. And I guess I got my feelings out on my sleeve, and I made that statement, and I should not have said that. And he told me that when I qualified to do something other than spin lug wrenches at the front of a tire store, that I could raise my ambitions. So I spun. Point four. Spewing, which is what I did, spewing always has some concrete ground for its manifestation. That is, overreacting or eating the wrong kind of food or bad food. Literally vomiting. Did you know when you vomit
is because of several things, and it's legitimate. I mean, people don't usually like to do that. It's a reaction that you have when you have bad food. You've eaten the wrong food or bad food. And the body wants to get rid of that. And you spew it out. And mentally this happens. You've got all these horrible attitudes. And something happens and you react to it. And you can't wait to tell everyone how bad it's been, how wrong you've been wronged, how bad you've been treated, and that something has to be done about it. And so if you can get someone to go to fight for you, they'll go in and tell all of this. And that's called collective bargaining. So these laborers have eaten rotten thoughts. Stomach takes rotten food, it regurgitates. Soul sucks in rotten thoughts, those thoughts get regurgitated. So they run their life on ill-digested principles. Christians run their lives on ill-digested principles because they don't know doctrine. And so they devise in their own mind what they think a biblical concept ought to be in their view. And then they run their life that way and they become complainers and whiners, gongudzo. And when the rotten soul is confronted with facts that violate its egocentric domination, it reacts by spewing forth its contents. I will not be denied. You know, people can stay with a story so long they believe it's true. Just stick with it. Say it over and over. Sell it. And finally people say, well, he's told the same story 100 times. It must be true. As he laughs up his sleeve. 6. In the Old Testament, the word murmur is loon. That's L-U-N, loon. With only one exception, all references are found in Exodus 15, chapters 15 through 17, in Numbers chapters 14 through 17. 21 total appearances. Loon is always accompanied by the preposition all, A-L, meaning against. So you murmur against an individual or a group of individuals. And therefore, there is opposition here. The subject of all this murmuring is the nation Israel. This is the first generation. These are the ones that have no doctrine. They've been steeped in idolatry. They've been steeped in all of the various religions that they've been exposed to in Egypt for over 400 years. They finally have freedom, and they are looking at Moses and Aaron, and they're the objects of their murmuring. They constantly gripe and whine to Moses and Aaron. So although the objects of their assault are Moses and Aaron, the truth is the real object is God, who commissioned the two patriarchs as duly appointed leaders of the people. They were doing their job best they could. Aaron and Moses failed on occasion. That doesn't change the fact that they were duly appointed. And therefore, the people should have responded to their leadership. If Moses and Aaron make mistakes, God will take care of that. The people have no business to intervene in any way. Yet they complain and tell them, "You've brought us out here to kill us." We spent, I guess, the better part of a year or more taking a look at the Exodus generation that began with the Exodus and was consummated by Joshua moving into the Promised Land. And that entire process took us down what was called the Santa Fe Trail. And we saw a lot of applications, circumstances that people can run into as they move into an area with which they're unfamiliar and therefore must depend upon principle and upon the guidance, direction, and protection of the God of the universe. And that was the essence of our study. And we finally completed that, and I think we finished it up with the burial of Moses. So loon always refers to the attitude of the Jews between deliverance from Egypt and entering the Promised Land. They are discontented with their lot in life. And thus, each and every one of them died, with two exceptions, Caleb and Joshua. And they deserved it, because if you get freedom, and they were being offered freedom in Canaan, And free people must have a mental attitude that can maintain that freedom. It is true in this country. We were told by our founders that you have been given a republic if you can keep it. And the only thing that can hold a republic together is the integrity of the people. The people must have integrity, or they will elect leaders who have no integrity. They will elect people who will give them largesse. They will vote largesse. And that's happening in this country. And there are moves now presently underway to enlarge the largesse class so that more and more who seek assistance and gifts from the government can have the dominant effect on who runs this country. We're about to be voted into slavery freely. We will freely vote ourselves into slavery, a form of slavery that can be called socialism, fascism, totalitarianism, or just pure communism. But however you add it up, as a people, once it's in play, we're not going to like it. We think that there is a goose out there that lays golden eggs, and that the goose will always lay them. There will always be a pile of golden eggs. And we just simply go out every day and get the eggs. I wonder how many of you have ever had chickens. My grandmother had chickens. And these chickens did seem to lay eggs every day. I don't know how they did it, but they did. And so you go out there every morning and you pull eggs out of the little nest deal and go in and have them for breakfast. And I assumed as long as the chickens were living, they were going to be laying those eggs. But at some point, chickens are going to die. And this goose that we've been depending upon has got really ill health right now. And it shows, and we've got the examples here in this passage that give us the mental attitude of a group of people who want everything given to them, but they don't want any adversities, difficulties, challenges. They want none of that. Everything must be rosy every day. We want stuff given to us. We don't like the manna. We want meat. And so they get the meat, and they're not happy with that. And so all the time it's whining. We don't like the food. Give us different food. Different food comes. They don't like it. They don't like anything because their soul is corrupted with a bad mental attitude. And when a group of people called a nation, when they exhibit a bad mental attitude, there is no way those people can be given freedom. And that's why they never went into the land. They were whiners, loon here in the Hebrew. The 12 tribes were elected by God to be His client nation. A client nation, mind you, one that would represent him in the devil's world. This first group could not qualify because they had garbage in their souls. Each Jew was therefore appointed as a missionary to Yahweh Elohim, but they were not men of integrity and therefore did not qualify to function as a client nation. Their appointment as a client nation, God's chosen people, was as much grace as the promise to lead them to the promised land. Well, I'm going to lead you to the promised land and you're going to be a client nation. But you must qualify by having doctrine in your souls and you must have the ability to submit to duly appointed authority. For I have given you the Torah. You will go by that. There's a lot of ritual there and you will learn theology from those rituals. I expect you to pay attention to the priesthood as they function in this manner. I expect you to do precisely what you're told when the moon tells you to do it. There's certain concepts of following the astronomy of the day. It would be Enochian school astronomy that Moses knew, that Aaron knew, and the priesthood knew. And they observed the moon phases, and they knew from the moon phase when certain functions of the priesthood were ready to go on for the people to practice. And there were the various feasts and so on. And they did this. They were forced to do it, but for them it was ritual without reality. It was without reality because they had a bad mental attitude. They were not team players. Their appointment as a client nation, God's chosen people, was as much grace as the promise to lead them to the promised land. But arrogance converts God's grace into a civil right. They expect God to care for them in every respect and lead them to a goal without them exerting any effort. there was a reconnaissance mission early in the Exodus. Went up into Canaan. There were 12 that went up there. And 12 came back, and the minority report was that we need to take the land. We can beat these people. And the other 10 whined and said, oh, no, no, we're grasshoppers in their sight. We can't go up there. They will kill us each and every one. Fear. Cowardice. God sent them there to reconnoiter the land, and they said, oh, we can't do this. People with a sour, defeatist mental attitude, self-centered and full of cowardly thoughts, cannot be free. Caleb and Joshua were the only ones to say, yeah, we can do this. But they were outvoted 5-1, 6-1. So arrogance converts God's grace into a civil right. They expect God to care for them in every respect and lead them to the goal without them exerting any effort. Grace is a benevolent grant from God. If he says he'll do it, he'll do it. It will be grace that does it. And they could not orient to grace. The thing that they needed to do was to learn the doctrine and apply it. And grace, therefore, would lead them to the promised land. In other words, they said, I don't want to have to do any thinking. Just take my hand, dear Jesus, and lead me home. I don't want to think. Let's just lead us, protect us. We don't have to do anything. I don't want to pay attention. I don't want to think. I don't want to concentrate. I don't want to change my mental attitude. I don't want to be bothered. Just take me home. And he wouldn't do it. They didn't qualify. Every time the Jews murmur, they claim that justice has not been done. You've brought us out here to kill us. In making these accusations, they rob God of his sovereignty. Such is considered by God to be a sin and is severely punished, and each and every one was, minus the two heroes, Caleb and Joshua. Such murmuring indicates a doubting of God. You doubt him. Go up there, reconnoiter the land, and take it. They doubted that they could do it. They didn't believe God would protect them. They were cowards, and they didn't have faith. They didn't understand grace, and therefore they spent another 39 years in the Hornada suffering all the way to death. Lazy, indolent people are murmurers who claim the high ground of violated rights in order to pressure government to intervene with the promise of votes in return. Gimme, give me, gimme, and I will vote for you. Politicians who lust for power gladly oblige. Murmuring is a manifestation then of an attitude of the whole man. If you're a murmurer, that defines you. Quit whining, quit griping. Get in with the plan of God. What's in your daytimer may be a surprise to you, but it was put there in the divine decree. And so it's up to you to orient and adjust to that with doctrine. If you don't have any doctrine, then you whine. Now, the correct attitude, in contrast to murmuring, is unconditional acceptance and obedience to the Word of God. That is the mental attitude that must be achieved in the soul of the individual that hopes to be a winner. That's the correct attitude. Unconditional acceptance and obedience to the Word of God. Don't know it? Who are you going to submit to? You're a coward. You're fearful. You have no way of understanding the events that are coming to reality around you. None of it's on your daytimer. And therefore, you look for a surrogate mama that will come to your aid, and that inevitably becomes the government. So the murmurer becomes one who judges and condemns God, in essence. You can't do it. Someone else can. Other fallen people are better at protecting and providing for me than a perfect God of the universe. I will depend upon people. They are more efficient. They're there. They promise. They say they'll do it. And I will support them. I will vote for them. And so we have this contract going where I vote and then they give. This is the antithesis of what should be directed toward God. There should be trust, gratitude, obedience, and personal love granted to God. He in grace will take care of you. It is a grace contract. It's His policy, and He is going to provide in some manner or fashion what He requires of you is loyalty to Him. Loyalty to Him, loyalty to His Word, and loyalty under pressure for application. But everything is negative to the person with the arrogant soul. They don't get it because they don't know the doctrine. They don't understand grace. So integrity, honor, virtue, rectitude, and probity are only words to the arrogant murmurer. They have none of these virtues. They have no integrity. They're into expediency. They have no honor. They're involved in self-centeredness. They have no virtue because they're involved in sin. And they have no rectitude and probity because they wouldn't know it if it walked up to them. Rectitude means a person who functions on standards and therefore seeks never to deviate from them. And the standards in their souls are flexible based on what they need for that given day. Now, they're only words for the arrogant murmurer. He only uses them as a lever to force others to acquiesce to their expedient demands. So on occasion, you'll see people take a righteous stand, apparently. But it is a tool. It is a means of accomplishing another objective. There are those who will say that we should allow all of these people who are presently flowing across the borders like water, that we're being unfair and unjust to these people because we all are immigrants, which is not true. I don't know about you, but I take my forebears back to prior to the independence. And we were a colony of Britain. This is British property. I'm a Brit. How about you? I'm not an immigrant, no more so than someone who lived in England in those days happened to also live in Scotland. These were the British colonies. My forebears go back to that. They were Brits, not immigrants, British. So the idea that we're all immigrants is not true. Also, the idea that anyone can come across the border that wants to work and, you know, do better for his family is a fine, noble idea. Okay? But let's do not discriminate about this. We should let the Chinese, we should let the Russians, the Cubans, the Bolivians, the Ukraine, Australians, New Zealanders, name the country. Why can't they come across at Laredo too? No questions asked. Why do we even need visas and passports anymore? We don't need those. Those are papers that they ask you for. You shouldn't be asked for your papers. So I think that when we go to the airport and we want to fly to the country and they say, let me see your visa, we should say, that is profiling. And profiling is wrong. The rationale and the logic that we have today is based on apparent thoughtfulness of other people, but it is designed as a hidden agenda. There's a hidden agenda being promoted and advanced behind all of that, and the hidden agenda here, which is not so hidden at all, is to get enough votes into the country so that one group of people can hold power for the foreseeable future. And they care not a whit about those poor people coming across the border. That's the attitude we're talking about here. They hold themselves high and mighty quite often, these types, claiming principles of integrity in order to advance some hidden agenda. So the idea of living up to his end of the bargain is superseded by the self-serving belief that he is being treated unfairly. The arrogant are able to clearly detect the faults and shortcomings of others, real or imagined, but they never see the faults in themselves. Being an arrogant, self-centered, expedient loser, he murmurs, or better, he spews the vile contents of his soul out where all can see what manner of man he really is. Who are the spewers? Unions, progressives, sycophant media, and the hoi polloi brainwashed by them. That's who the spewers are today. Here's an expanded translation of how far we've gone in Matthew 20, verses 1 through 11. The kingdom of heaven is like a capitalist who went out around 6 in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After he had reached an agreement, a contract, with the labor union for the customary daily wage of 1 denarius, he sent them into his vineyard. Around 9 o'clock in the morning, he departed, and on arriving at the agora, he saw other laborers standing around unemployed. He said to them, "You also go into the vineyard. Whatever's right's what I will pay you." And so they went. And he departed again around high noon, and once more around 3 o'clock, and he did similarly. And around 5 o'clock, he departed and found still others standing around, and he asked them, "Why have you been standing here the whole day unemployed?" "Because no one has hired us," they responded. And he said to them, "You also go into the vineyard." And at 6 o'clock in the afternoon, the viticulturalist said to the payroll clerk, "Call the workers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last ones hired and going on to the first ones hired." And the employees who were hired around 5 o'clock came to the payroll clerk, and each received a fair day's wage of 1 denarius. And so when those came who were hired first, that's 6 a.m., they presumptuously assumed that they would receive more than the others. But each one of them received a fair day's wage, namely a denarius, which is what they were under contract to receive. Verse 11, "Thus when they had received their fair day's wage, they spewed the contents of their souls against the capitalist." King James Version of verse 12 reads this way, "And they said this, 'These last have wrought but 1 hour, and thou hast made them equal to us, which have borne the burden of the heat of the day.'" This is where surrogate mama enters the scene. Verse 12 introduces us to the first century version of Cesar Chavez, the leader of the United Farm Workers of America. When I taught this back in mid-1985, it probably was in August, because I have an article here from Time Magazine. August 19th, 1985, page 36, under Business Notes, the article is entitled "Grape Boycott Round 3. Interesting. Grape Boycott. Cesar Chavez. And so I went to the archives of Time Magazine, because I'd read it right out of the magazine back then, and I found it. Here's what they were doing 25 years ago. Like an echo from the past, Cesar Chavez, leader of the United Farm Workers of America, is back in the news. Between 1965 and 1973, he organized 2 great boycotts and 1 passage in 1975 of the first state law guaranteeing farm workers the right to unionize. Now Chavez is again launching a boycott of California grapes, contending that the 1975 law is rarely enforced. He says, quote, "Farm workers continue to be fired, coerced, and abused by corporate growers." Chavez blames California Governor George Duke Majan for much of the problem. What's the problem with Duke Majan? Here we go. The union leader accuses the governor of ignoring workers' rights and accepting $1 million in campaign contributions from agricultural interests. An aide to the governor admits that Duke Majan has received money from growers, but says that Chavez's figure is too high. To promote his boycott, this shows you that times never change. To promote his boycott, Chavez has traveled from Los Angeles to Boston, picking up endorsements from such prominent politicians as Senators Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts and Paul Simon of Illinois. Surely you remember him. Chavez thinks that if he can get just 6% of the population to stop eating grapes, growers will be forced to listen to his union's complaints. What have these guys done? They formed a union, and now they're complaining. Just like Cesar Chavez does for the American Grape Growers Union. Now, in our passage, the first century Senor Chavez represents his equivalent United Farm Workers before this capitalist. In verse 12, the surrogate mama speaks and issues two major complaints that he feels justifies breaking the contract. Number one, all workers, union and scab, have been made equal. Two, the union workers had to work in the hot weather more than the scabs did for the same money. That's the grievance. So let's take a look at that. All workers have been made equal. Isn't that what we go for here? Isn't that what everybody wants? Is it to be equal? Spreading the wealth. Two, the union workers had to work in the hot weather, spinning them lug wrenches, picking them grapes. And they had to do it more than the scabs did for the same amount of money. Now note the inconsistency. Now equality is an evil. Everybody wants to get paid the same. See, we bargained for the denarius. Everybody gets the same regardless of how many grapes we pick. We got a guy over there that's a slacker. He's a one-armed guy. He can only pick half as much as anybody else. Yet he gets the same thing, and that's what we bargained for. Now, equality is an evil thing. Inequality is sought, but only where it is expedient for the union. Equality was the platform for the contract, and they now seek to break the contract so that inequality can now be observed. There's no consistency. The arguments that they come up with and present are simply rhetorical veils to advance while concealing the hidden agenda. And that's to bilk as much money out of the capitalist as possible, to cast aspersions upon him anytime they decide they want more. Now, the word equal is interesting. I-S-O-T-E-S, asates, and it does mean equal. This is a Greek word. It has to do with acknowledgement of one's rights. It has to do with one's equal status. One citizen's position is equal in value and nature to that of another's. Equality is a legitimate concept when we speak of equality before the law. No one should have an advantage against another with regard to the law. We're all equal before the law. But when it comes to the concept of outcomes and one's general daily function, then equality therefore becomes a detriment to all. You should be able to advance as far as your talents, abilities, effort, and integrity can take you, where other people absolutely have no desire to put forth that kind of effort, nor do they have the integrity. Therefore, they should not prosper to the same degree as the person who tries much harder. Inequality, therefore, is a virtue with regard to outcome. With regard to enforcement of the laws of the land, we should all be equal. And our laws obviously reflect these concepts. At least they used to. Now, the elimination of one's feelings, prejudices, and desires so as to achieve a proper balance of conflicting interests is also a concept behind the word asates. The elimination of one's feelings, prejudices, and desires so as to achieve a proper balance of conflicting interests. and indicates fairness and that one is not a respecter of persons. And that would be the proper function for this landowner. He had no respect of persons. He's the owner. He's the one with the money. He can do with it what he wants to. And so he didn't respect the union. He decided he would be gracious to all, as God is gracious to you. The person that is saved 2 minutes before the rapture gets to go to heaven just like Paul does. He gutted it out for 2,000 years in an interim body. This guy gets a resurrection body in 2 minutes. All the first century people are going to complain. I had to wander around in an interim body for 2,000 years, and this guy gets a resurrection body in 2 minutes. That's not fair. And the Lord will look at him, and he'll say, I'm running the show. I'm the landowner. I own the vineyard. Here's some notes on our guy, Chavez. And I've noted by the clock here that Cesar is going to take up far too much time. I don't know. Let's blitz this. Just a few notes here on Chavez. Chavez is upset because the capitalist has made all equal. They have as much as we do. That was a bargain in the beginning. We all wanted a denarius. This is the direct antithesis of usual union philosophy, which promotes equal employment, equal rights, equal input to decision-making with management. Unions claim to seek equality for the proletariat, that's the working class, but in truth what they really seek is power. But the power they seek simply doesn't exist. Let's take a look at Colossians 3 again. That's where we started our study. There we learned that the system delegates power to certain individuals, never to groups. The Bible delegates power to individuals, never groups. Let's take a look. You as an individual have power over your own volition. Volition submits to your decision-making process. Husband has the authority over the wife. Individual. Parents, who are one in union, over children. The teacher over the students. The coach over the athletes. The officer over the enlisted men. And, of course, the employer, owner, chairman of the board, president, over the employees. None of these subservient categories possess any authority. Therefore, any power they may seek is a power which does not legitimately exist. And therefore, if they gain the power, they've gained it illegitimately, and therefore no good can come from it. When such false power is acquired, it creates an imbalance within the system, and the system will break down accordingly, and that is what is going on in this country. Go back and look. Do people really have control over their free will, or is their emotion taking over the volition, and therefore making decisions based on what I want rather than what they ought? Husbands over wives. Wives running the show or no husband at all. Single mamas, because they couldn't get along, didn't marry the right person. He's a philanderer and got run off. Whatever the situation, that's the concept. The wife is left to run a show that she's not designed to totally manage. And the children suffer. Parents over children. So many households, the children run the parents. If you scream loud enough and long enough, they'll say, please, I'll give you anything you want if you will shut up. And then they grin as they receive what it was they wanted. Teachers over students. Students gain control of the classroom. Athletes gain control over the coach. Enlisted men gain the advantage over the officer. And the employees have the advantage over the employer. And that's mainly what unions do, is they gain control of the corporation and destroy it. Now, I've heard arguments that unions, in a basic concept of unions, is fine because sometimes management is unfair to workers. Well, it's the devil's world. Sometimes labor is unfair to management. says, can management form a union because of the unfairness of laborers? I think there's a law against that. What you need to do is have integrity. You don't need any of this. But we don't have that, so we have to have these different structures that emerge as things that can put out fires for the moment but don't really solve the problem. So if this imbalance is not corrected, then the system self-destructs. So verse 12 reads this way, these men who were hired last worked only 1 hour, and you've made them equal to us. We'll see more about that complaint, that grievance, tomorrow evening. Father, we thank you for the opportunity and privilege of noting these things. It's important with regard to the current zeitgeist that we understand precisely what is going on, where it came from, the mental attitudes behind it, and why it is a detriment to our freedom. Motivate and encourage us regarding these things as we lift our prayer. In Christ's name, amen.